What's going on, everyone? Swim Kareem back with another episode of the Nonprofit Insider Podcast, episode 44. We're only 6 episodes away from episode 50. That's going to be a good one. I'm hoping to get a really big guest on that one. It might honestly just be me talking. What better way to celebrate 50 years than by giving myself the platform to talk? But we got a good episode today. Be sure to follow us on Instagram. Be sure to follow us on TikTok. We've always got some interesting things happening there. I just dropped a video a couple of days ago about my time. I was in Scottsdale. Had a chance to get into a self-driving car called Waymo. Definitely something we do not have here in Albuquerque. But go ahead, follow me on Instagram and on TikTok. I talk a little bit about that and share some videos of me getting in the car. And it's crazy being in like a self-driving car. I know a lot of people have like Teslas and they do self-driving or whatnot, but it's like Uber, but there's no driver. It's unreal. My girlfriend was like, honestly, I'd prefer this than getting in the back of an Uber. Some guy, you don't know the guy, he could take you somewhere. You know what? I'm just going to get into the self-driving car. It's going to get me to where I need to go. I don't have to get in a car with a stranger. She was all about it. And that says a lot, because when I said, oh, hey, we're going out, you know, we're going to hang out in Phoenix, hang out in Scottsdale. I got a friend. They want us to get into this self-driving car. She was kind of like, And I was like, this friend has been talking about it for a year. So shout out to you, Megan. Shout out to you, Dan. You two are awesome. We appreciate the love every time we're out there in Scottsdale. Classic episode today. I'm going to have a good main segment. I'm going to talk about scams and scams affecting the nonprofit space, specifically affecting like people that donate, but nonprofits are not immune. There are a lot of nonprofits that can get scammed out of money. I'm going to talk about scamming in the nonprofit space. We've got a great nonprofit horror story. I'm going to share one of my own. I don't think I've shared a single nonprofit horror story this year that was my own. I think I've only been sharing other people. So we're long overdue. We're getting ready to hop into summer. June is usually when I do the Nonprofit Horror Story Summer Series, June and July. So we've got some stuff happening there. So I got a nice horror story coming up here in about 20, 25 minutes or so. And then here in a little bit, I'm going to talk about a nice little news piece where we're talking about some donor advice funds. If you haven't heard of a DAF, they're in the news a little bit. IRS is doing some public meetings around donor advice funds. So we're going to talk about that because, look, there's always money in the nonprofit space and there's a lot of money that is exchanged. And whenever you're talking money, you're talking power. And whenever you're talking power, you're talking American life, right? So we're going to talk about that here in a little bit. Again, follow us on Instagram, follow us on TikTok. What am I seeing? I'm always like, am I missing something? It's windy here in Albuquerque. It's super funny. I was actually going to hop on a bike. I was like, I'm going to hop on a bike. But it's so freaking windy that I'm like, I don't even want to leave my house. In some places, you know, if you're like New York or Detroit or, I don't know, Toronto, you're like, I want to go outside, but the weather's bad because it's snowy or raining. Here, if it's windy, it's just too much. So shout out to all of New Mexico. Shout out to the Southwest. I don't know if we have a single listener in Western Texas, but Western Texas, that's a place there is a lot of wind out there. So shout out to those areas. When it gets too bad on the wind, you don't even go outside. You really don't. So, and be sure to listen to the previous episode. I talk about the Met Gala. Episode 43, the Met Gala was 2 Mondays ago, the first Monday of every May. A lot of famous people wearing dresses and stars, but I talk about some of the ramifications of the Met Gala and where that money goes. I haven't seen the official numbers yet, but it was projected that $25 million were going to be raised for the Met Gala for the Costume Institute of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. $25 million. I talk about how that works. How does the nonprofit status works when you're talking about a museum that is considered to be like the 4th or 5th largest museum in the world right there in New York City. So listen to episode 43 where I talk about the Met Gala and some of the things behind it. Honestly, I think that's it. Let's hop to it. But first, let me tell you about my friends at artoftea.com. You've heard of artoftea.com. I've been talking about them for some time here on the podcast because, look, you like a good cup of tea. I know for me, after my son was born, There was about a solid 4 or 5 years where I was drinking coffee every day, and it was good, and it was nice at the time. But deep down, I was always a tea fan, even before he came into this world. And one of the things is, I was like, you know, I want a little bit of caffeine, or I want, you know, something a little bit light in the morning or anything like that. And that's where artoftea.com comes in. And they have this really cool thing called the Tea Club. Sounds really fancy, right? Where they'll send you teas directly in the mail. They have 3 month subscription, 6 month subscription, even 12 month subscription. And here's the thing. I usually personally, I like a good herbal tea, like a good green tea, a good caffeine free tea, but black teas aren't really my thing. I can get this 6 month subscription, and for a lot of those black teas, I actually don't tell anyone, but I multi-purpose them. And so I turn them around and I'll re-gift them. And then I kind of bundle them up. And for the people in my life that I know like black teas, they are a great opportunity for me to use them for birthdays, surprises, anniversaries, or just little gifts that I can send in the mail to folks. Be sure to go to artoftea.com. I've got 10% off for you in the show notes. So go to the show notes, check them out. We appreciate our friends at artoftea.com. All right, and we're back. Earlier in the week, it was actually just on, I think it was like Sunday. I think it was on Sunday. I'm like, let me just look here. I think it was like Sunday or last week, something like that. I saw a little memo from the IRS. I followed the IRS on Instagram. And actually, they're what, as you would imagine, it's kind of boring. They don't do anything super crazy. But I always like seeing what's happening with the IRS because they really are, in a lot of ways, one of the big overseers or connectors when it comes to the nonprofit space, because they provide the tax exemption. We already know that. But I saw this a little note. It was on the AP. It was by Stephanie Beasley, an article. And this was originally posted, actually, on the Chronicle of Philanthropy. But I go to the AP, and they have a partnership. It's just easy to get the information there. And the article title said, and I quote, "The $230 billion donor-advised fund industry gets an IRS hearing." So I said, well, let me check this out. Listen, I'll be honest. I don't know a whole lot about DAFs, donor-advised funds. I know a little bit about them, but this is something I think this year, and I think moving forward, I'm going to dive a lot deeper into donor-advised funds. So let me take a step back here before we get into this article and really kind of explain what a DAF is. So a donor advised fund, it's where you have the ability to contribute cash, securities, or you could just contribute other assets to a donor advised fund at a public charity. And usually that public charity is deemed to be a sponsoring organization. I'm going to use Fidelity Charitable as the example, because they are the largest, they're the largest grant maker in the United States. In 2023, they gave $11.8 billion. And the whole reason I even first started learning about donor advised funds was simply because of Fidelity Charitable. I was like, well, what are the charities, what are the organizations that are giving the most money? And I'm like, Fidelity Charitable? Like, I know, you know, Fidelity, obviously, stocks, trades, assets, all that stuff, they have a lot of money. But this was like maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and I'm like, they don't have $9 billion. Like, how are they getting all this money? And turns out that they are Fidelity's 501c sister is called Fidelity Charitable. And so what you do is you can give them, you know, cash, donor assets, securities, things like that. And those funds can be invested for tax-free growth, and then you as the donor have the ability to advise where the money goes, hence donor-advised fund. The big advantage to a DAF is that generally you're able to take an immediate tax reduction or deduction. So I have $10 million, just a round number. I have $10 million. I give it to Fidelity Charitable. Let's say I give them $5 million 1 year, $5 million the next year. I'm able to get those tax deductions pretty much right away. Usually in the same calendar year, I can go ahead and put those on my taxes and get some tax advantages, right? There's some controversy around different aspects of that. We'll talk about that here in about maybe 5 minutes or so. But that's basically how a donor advised fund works. And it's super funny because here in Albuquerque, there's this fun. I actually was talking to a CEO of a donor advised fund. He leads the foundation. I'm not going to give their name out, but he leads this foundation, and their foundation is really based more on aspects of religion. Bringing about the kingdom is what they would probably say. And they have a more Christian religious type of vibe where they get all this money from various donors and supporters, and then they in turn use that money to give out to different organizations that have a more religious, more Christian type of spear, because that's where the donors, I mean, if I'm, listen, I'll be honest, if I'm giving you $1 million, you know, and I'm giving it to you as a charity fund versus a charity itself. So instead of giving $1 million to St. Jude's, I give it to you all, and you say, okay, I'm going to take this $1 million. We're going to immediately invest $900,000 of it, and we're going to start getting interest from that money. That's what Fidelity does. They start getting interest from that money, and then every single year they have the ability to say, okay, we're going to give money to this charity that we think is doing good and promoting Christian values, you know, whatever the case may be, whatever the case may be. So honestly, I can't blame them, because if I'm giving you this money, it's nice to be able to not only do I get the tax benefits, but I get some of the ability to determine where it goes. I mean, that's freaking perfect, all right? There's an organization here in Albuquerque, New Mexico. It's called Future Fund. They are a part, I think they're under the, let me just do a double quick check. I want to make sure. They're a part of the Albuquerque, I think it's, I don't know, I'm typing it, ABQ Future Fund. They're a part of the Albuquerque Community Foundation. That's what they are part of. I can't remember if it was Albuquerque Foundation or Community, but they're part of the Albuquerque Community Foundation. And usually what they have is, it's a collection of people in the city of Albuquerque that come together and they give 200 on average, I think actually it's not even on average. I think it's regardless. To be a member of this fund, you have to give them $200 a year. Not really a whole lot. So it's like you and maybe 100 other people. They tend to get a lot of younger people, like 45 years of age and younger. It's a great networking opportunity. I've never been a part of it, but you know, it's you. It's 125 other young, aspirational, inspiring type of people. You get this money together, and then what they do is they do an annual grant cycle. So they may have, say, $25,000 a year based off of all these people coming together. They have networking events, they meet, and it's a way for them to really grow power, right? Because again, with the nonprofit space, and I'll say this forever, where there's money, there's power. And when there's power, there's going to be a lot of influence and things of that nature. So no surprise, right? There are a lot of nonprofits that, I mean, let's just be honest here. They are desperately trying to get in on the pie. If they have $25,000 every year and they open it up to the grant cycle, how many nonprofits in Albuquerque or in the greater Albuquerque area are trying to get their hands on some of that money? I have the money, I have the power, you come to me and you're on your knees trying to get some of the money. It's a case as old as time. It's nothing out of this world. But the big thing with Future Fund is they give the money out every single year. One of the critiques of a donor advised fund is that you collect this money and you don't have a designated timetable to give it. Now, a lot of people that you may be listening to this and you may be familiar with the 5% payout rule in the nonprofit space. It's the basic idea that if you are a foundation, if you are an organization that hoards money to that like type of degree, every year you're giving out at least 5% of your foundational money to organizations. There are a lot of people that have asked that number to be increased to 10%. Or 15%. I am personally one of those people. I think there are a lot of nonprofits that are using the money and they're investing it to gain more money, but they're not necessarily using it to better society as a whole. That's another conversation we could talk about. But if you give, let's say, again, I give $10 million to Fidelity Charitable. They take that money. I get the tax benefits right away. I get the advantage of saying, hey, I want the money to go here or there or anywhere, but there's no timetable to do that. And so there's a lot of critiques. And so going back to this article, I'm going to put it in the chat. The $230 billion advised fund industry gets an IRS hearing. They talk about that, how, and I'm going to do a little bit of a quote here. I'm going to read it verbatim and quote, "To the dismay of DAF critics, the IRS's proposal doesn't touch on whether donors should be required to pay out of their funds within a certain time frame to receive immediate tax breaks." Quote, or end quote. That is a really big issue. That is a really big issue. The warehousing of wealth that people have gotten deductions today for and actually aren't helping people who knows how long into the future. This is from, end quote, Hitachi Mayer, I believe. So this is a really big thing where if the IRS is saying, hey, we're going to give you the tax benefits, boom, right away. And then that non-501c3 organization that is really just a collection of money managers, if we're being honest, is taking all of this money and holding on to it and investing it. But then it could be there for 5 years, 8 years, 10 years before it's even given to a charity. That's worth a discussion. And so I'll be following up on this. I think this is very interesting for you nonprofit nerds. You are really going to want to look at this. But now, if nothing else, you walking away from this episode now know what a donor advice fund is. And you can learn about some of the biggest donor advice funds that are out there, because it is interesting. It is interesting. All right, time for our main segment of the day. This is where we get into something. Usually about 10 minutes. I try to get you out of here before we get to the nonprofit horror story. One of the things, when you're getting as many emails as we are getting in today's world, as many forms of communications, it's actually surprising that we don't get more of these. But I got a scam email. So let me read it here real fast, because I think you'll appreciate it. It says, and I'm going to read the whole thing, quote, "Hello! Exclamation point. We need some financial help from you to build homes for homeless people after flood disaster. We required around $600,000, and with your $600,000 charity, we will be able to help 15 families, because cost of one house occurs $40,000 in our country. Please convey this message and help us according to your financial capacity. Please reply us as we messaging you with hope. We know you are a philanthropist too and do a lot of charity." Well, they pat on my back. Gosh. I'll continue. "You can send us online. Once you acknowledge this message, we will send you the once you acknowledge this message, we will send you the details. We are working on built homes for homeless people, in which we need your financial help, as we found you philanthropists. Thanks in advance." And then it came with a link, and of course I did not click that link, but I did copy the message, because again, surprising. In all my days, we've all gotten emails, right? Can you help me? I'm starting up a GoFundMe. But specifically, this message really hits on a couple of things, right? Financial help, homelessness, flood disasters, charity. What's your financial capacity? We know you are a philanthropist. That's my favorite line. We're working to build homes for homeless people. I don't know what country this is in. I don't know what flood they're talking about. We know this is a scam, right? But scams are shockingly harder and harder to distinguish. According to the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, back in 2022, they received 10,000 reports of charitable fraud. So we're not talking, fried Blankman, I think that's his name. We're not talking, those types of, scams and stock scams. Specifically, 10,000 reports of charitable scams, and those are just the ones that they know. I'd be curious. I'd imagine there's probably way more charity scams that are happening out there, but 10,000 reports of charity scams totaling $21 million. That's also a shocking number. You would think that number would be a lot higher, but that's still a lot of money. And that's a lot of money that's just not getting into the hands of a lot of charities. And I have some thoughts around it. The first thought, it's going to happen. It's sad to say, but it's going to happen. one of the things with the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, is they said they receive usually about anywhere from 30 to 35%. I think it's actually like 36%. Anywhere from 30 to 35% of all the charitable scam reports that they get come right after the holidays. Because that's the time when people get a little, maybe they get a little bit more money, they get bonuses. And then we know what the second most popular time is? Tax return season. People get money and they're like, you know, I don't want to do a little bit of charity giving April and then November and December. So it's going to happen. There are always going to be ways to scam people out of their money. I know for me, even I was scammed. I hopped on PayPal, which I don't like PayPal. There's just something about the system, maybe because it's connected to Elon Musk in his past. But there's just something about PayPal. Like I just don't like it. I'd rather do a lot of other things. But, you know, I was hanging out with the girlfriend. I had an edible. Listen, legal in New Mexico. Had an edible. It was a Sunday. I was chilling. Get a phone call. Beep, 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 beep. We noticed that you tried to make a purchase on PayPal. Did you try to make this purchase? I'm like, what? Click two. No. Please confirm. You know, say yes or something like that. I said no or yes or something like that. Hung up. All right, cool. Get another call saying, hey, this is your bank. And I'm like, again, I had that edible, having a good time. I could not believe it. I was such an idiot because as soon as I got off that second call, I was like, fuck. Fuck, fuck, fuck. I could not believe it. I totally got scammed. Now, thankfully, I only got scammed out of like $50 and I did get my money back. But it's bound to happen. And so you got to be really careful and cautious. So I'm going to give some tips to avoid charity scams here in a little bit. But I actually love a good scam story. I listened to a podcast through AARP. They're one of my favorite nonprofits out there. And they have a podcast called The Perfect Scam. Very good, because you know a lot of scams target older individuals, right? People that have money, they have the resources, but maybe they don't know the ins and outs of scams and modern scams that happen. And they have some absolutely wild scam stories on that podcast. Highly recommend it. That's not an advertisement. That's a free promotion. That's a free plug, because that podcast is good. And of course, they have a couple of charity scams that are out there. Hey, I'm trying to help this homeless center. Hey, I just started a GoFundMe for my kids' college tuition. Can you help me? And they teach you all the different ways to avoid scams. And one of the things with charity scams is that it really hits on something that I think a lot of people may not realize. Charity scams do an amazing job because, and I've been saying this all podcasts, money is power. And there is something very, very powerful about whether you have $200 million to give or with Albuquerque Future Fund, $200 to give. When you are holding that money in your hand and you have the ability to give that money to an organization, it's pretty freaking cool. It's pretty freaking cool. And there's something about when I go to like a TJ Maxx to buy some, I don't know, washcloths, or I go to Home Depot to pick up some lumber, I give them that $200. I'm looking for an equal exchange. But when I have that $200 and I'm giving it to a charity, I'm looking for something that's going to be mission-driven, something that's going to make a change in someone's life, directly or indirectly, whether that money is going to overhead of a nonprofit or if that money is going directly into someone's hands. That is very, very powerful. And when you get on a phone call with someone and they say, hey, I'm looking for help. Can you help me? And you have the ability to give that person money. That's pretty powerful. It can feel good. And I tell people, when you're entering into the nonprofit space as a volunteer, a board member, a worker, a donor, there is something very powerful about feeling like you're helping society in a way that isn't just profit-driven, like being the CEO of Home Depot, right? When you're the executive director of a nonprofit, you feel like whether you are doing donor advisor funds or whatnot, you are, if nothing else, you feel like you're helping society in a slightly different avenue or a slightly different way. And it feels good. But you got to be careful. And so look, there's some tips out there that you see all over, but I'm going to give you some easy ones that I think everyone should to do. And now, and this is one of the things I want to say. Nonprofits are not exempt from being scammed themselves. I don't have as many reports of that. I tried to look at a couple, and I saw some, but I was like, nothing I could really talk about. But I know there are nonprofits that do get scammed. If you don't have the checks and balances, you can get scammed. Or if nothing else, you can get taken for a ride. I think you see that a lot more often where nonprofits, they're trying to do good, and then there are entities that will say, hey, we can help you do good. And then before you know it, you're locked in a contract you don't like. You done made a purchase for a shitty vehicle for your fleet. You know, there can be all types of ways where you're like, the fuck? I think I just got screwed. You may not have gotten scammed, but you may have gotten screwed. And so here's some tips. One of the first things I always say, and this is just a more philosophical thing, back to when I was working in sales, we used to always try to get the customer to buy right then and there. You can do a little bit of pressuring, right? This is when I was in car sales. If you don't buy today, I've got someone on the call right now. This is what I used to sell people. I've got someone who's planning on coming in later this week to look at that exact same used car you're looking at. I'd consider buying it now. You can add a little bit of pressure. The number one thing I always tell people, before you donate any money, sleep on it. Even if it's just for a day, sleep on it. Go home, think about it, talk to your spouse, talk to your family, talk to your friends. And just sleep on it before you give that money up, right? Whether you're writing a check, whether you're giving information, whatever you're doing, just sleep on it. The second thing that I always encourage people to do, and I've been doing this myself, not necessarily in giving money, but as I'm looking, I'm always looking, you know, what are some of the opportunities out there for sponsors, new jobs, you know, whatever the case may be, call to verify. Just call and verify. Before you get too deep into anything, just go, hey, let me just call this organization back. Hey, I'm looking at donating money and I'm talking to such and such. Do they work for you? You know, look at their website. Check those things out. Call and get confirmation. When at all possible, just donate directly. Donate directly. It's one of the biggest advantages you can do. Go direct to a website, go direct to an office if you can, and donate the money directly. And do credit card or check. Avoid cash. Have a little bit of a system. You know, listen, if you use your credit card, not your debit card, specifically your credit card, you know, do it that way. That's where you have a little bit of a track record. You can be covered, you know, whatever the case may be. And never, ever, ever donate money over the phone. Unless you really know, like I know we've had people, I've worked with nonprofits and it's like, hey, I'm going to call the operations person. I've been working with this operations person for a long time. I know they're at least going to get the information and put it in. They could scam me, of course, but I'm going to talk directly. But never give over the phone if you do not know who you're talking with. Avoid it like the plague. It's a big no, 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 no. All right, and we're back. Time for our favorite segment of any episode. Time for our nonprofit horror story. Back when I was in college, I went to college in North Carolina. A lot of you already know this, but back when I was in college, I ended up for two summers after my AmeriCorps time had ended. I ended up working at a summer camp through the Autism Society of North Carolina. The Autism Society of North Carolina, they're mainly based out of Raleigh. They have satellite offices, as you would imagine, Wilmington, Charlotte, Asheville, probably a couple other places I can't think of right now. They're listed as a 501c3. They do an amazing job of sharing their tax information on their website. I had a chance. I just looked at it. They get about $6.5 million last year, so they're kind of hovering around now. A lot of money from the government, as you would imagine, and they were established back in 1970. And one of the things they did every year that was really, really phenomenal for family members of people that are diagnosed with autism is they would have summer camps. And they would do one in that greater Raleigh area. And then they would do another in the greater Asheville area, specifically in a town called Black Mountain. Gorgeous. If you've never had a chance to go and see, one, the Appalachian area, in the South. When you're in that Kentucky, North Carolina, Georgia area, absolutely gorgeous. And so Black Mountain, North Carolina, absolutely gorgeous. I mean, yeah, even just when I was there, I appreciated it, but not being back there in 18 years or so, just absolutely gorgeous. And so they used to hold this summer camp there. I think they still do. I think they shut it down for a little bit, came back after about 3-4 years or something like that. And it was a great opportunity. One of the things that the leader, her name was Elsa Burnett. I think that was her last name. Elsa is Burnett, way before the Frozen movies came out. An amazing leader, someone I would definitely follow even to this day. She was an amazing leader. Shout out to you, Elsa. One of the things she always used to remind us, her and a lot of her team members around us or around her would say, is that this was oftentimes one of the few opportunities a year where if you had a kid diagnosed with autism, a teenager, if you had an adult, a lot of people forget, like, yes, if you are a 4-year-old or a 5-year-old or a 6-year-old with autism, you're going to grow up. So you could be 22, 36, 56. We had an adult week where we would have camps, and the camp was 8 weeks. I think it was 8 weeks or 7 weeks. I think it was, I might have been 7 weeks. The camp was 7 weeks over the summer, and every week was a different week. And some weeks it would just be kids age 6 to 10, or kids 10 to say 13, or say 18 to 36, or say 25 to older. And one of the things that Elsa and her team used to always remind us is that this is one of the few opportunities where if you were a caretaker of someone diagnosed with autism, it was an opportunity where you would drop that person off on, say, Monday. I think it was Sunday. You would drop off the person that you were sending to camp on Sunday, drop them off on Sunday, and then you wouldn't pick that kid up or that person up again until Saturday. So for that whole week, I would oftentimes get a lot of parents, a lot of caretakers that would say, oh, we didn't do anything. We rented a hotel room here in the city, and we just slept and ate dinner and just relaxed. Or sometimes they would drop, maybe you had 3 kids, right? And one of them was diagnosed with autism. So maybe you take the other 3 kids, if you were rich enough, you know, maybe you take the other 3 kids to Disney World, gave them a good time, while the one kid just chilled and hung out. Really phenomenal work. I actually really, really loved it. Great mission. And their mission is the Autism Society of North Carolina provides or improves the lives of individuals with autism and supports. I mean, you can't really get any better than that. But there were some horrific moments. I don't even call them horrific moments, honestly. They're more like growing pains. But the number one growing pain that really stuck out to me, and this was honestly probably the hard sell, because I remember I was working with a former mentor of mine in college, and she was trying to convince me. Her name was Kate Bowen. She was trying to convince me to do this with her because she had did it 1 year. And so she was like, hey, I think you should sign up to be a part of this summer camp as a camp counselor. And I just remember thinking, I don't know. And the main reason is because they used to get in the pool 3 times a day. And so what would happen is you would be assigned basically a camper. And so it would be a one-on-one camper, sometimes a 1 to 2. If that person was considered high function, I do not think they use that language anymore. To my understanding, autism is viewed a lot more in the sphere of a circle, like a sphere versus a scale that used to be like low function and high function. I think that verbiage is being outdated, and probably rightfully so. There are people that are in that space that know a lot more of that than I do. So please, if my language is wrong, please don't hold me super high there. But you would get a camper. And so on Sunday, I would meet the camper for the first time, and I was with that camper all week except for one day. We would have a day off during the week. Sometimes it'd be Wednesday, Thursday. It would just depend. It'd be kind of random, right? Not important. But I would hang out with that camper. We start the day at like 8 a.m. Go pick up the camper from, because it was an overnight camp. You pick up the camper, you do go to breakfast with them, you do activities with them, and then you'd get in the pool three times a day. You get in the pool at 11 a.m. for, I think it was like 45 to 50 minutes. I don't think it was an hour, but I think it was close to an hour, like 45, 50 minutes. So we'd get in the pool at 11 a.m. We'd get in the pool at 3 p.m. And then we'd get in the pool after dinner at around like 6 or 6:30 p.m. I can't remember the exact time. Folks, even when you're 19 years old, even when you're 20 years old, I was 20 and 21. I did it when I was 20 and 21 years old. It's really freaking hard to get into a pool in North Carolina, even in the middle of summer. It's hot. It's humid. And still you're like, this pool is fucking cold. It's 11 in the morning. I've only been up for 3 hours and I'm in the pool. And 2 hours later, I got to get in the pool again. I mean, there was breaks in between. Like we'd have like an hour break. The campers or the camp counselors would have an hour break to themselves. But still, getting in a pool three times a day, it's a reason why only young people are doing it. It was so it's exhausting. I mean, one of the things is you would be in the pool, right? And as you're in the pool, there's usually one person that kind of serves as like the lifeguard, right? To make sure everyone's safe. Because this pool isn't super big, right? But there was another person, another camp counselor that was like higher up, like the manager. And the manager was only like 24 years old. They're only like 3 years older than us. So that manager would usually just stand there. And once it was time to start getting people out, they would do it in increments because the locker room wasn't that big. So they would have... So they would look and they go, all right, let's say there's like 15 of us in the pool. They would look and they say, okay, three of you, one, two, and three, you all get out, go to the pool. And then they would wait. And then 5 minutes later, okay, you three, now you get out and now you go to the locker room. Wait another 5 minutes. So you would oftentimes hope that you are one of the first people to get out of the pool. But if you had a camper who really, really liked staying in the pool, guess what? You stayed in the pool with them. And that was always the rule. If your camper was in the pool, you were in the pool. You couldn't be staying out on the sidelines. You couldn't be outside the pool chilling. No. If your camper was in the pool, you were in the pool too. Exhausting. Freaking loved it though. Loved it so much that I did it one summer. And then the very next summer, I was like, yeah, I'm going to do it again. Even with the pool, even knowing I had to get in the pool three times a day. There were days you would just pray for rain because you'd be like, there were days you'd be so tired. I mean, you're hanging out with the other counselors. I mean, we're all 20, 29, 21, you know, we're all like young people. So we'd go out to dinner, you know, get some pizza, you know, hang out, things like that. But there were days you'd get in that pool and you'd be like, oh my gosh, you look at the forecast. This is before iPhones were super big. I mean, this is like 2007. You'd look at the weather report and go, oh my gosh, it's supposed to rain today. Thank God, because I do not want to get in that fucking pool today. So that's my nonprofit horror story. Shout out to the Autism Society of North Carolina. Shout out to all the folks that I worked with. Some really, really amazing folks that I haven't connected with some more than others, but just an amazing opportunity and amazing time doing that. Be sure to send me over your nonprofit horror stories. I am always looking for more. So send them over to me at Instagram. You can reach me at thenonprofitinsider@gmail. Other than that, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple or Spotify. We will see you on the next episode. We've got more great episodes happening all this summer. We'll see you later. Take care.